We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 94. On today's show, we talk about Balkan heritage and finding frescoes. Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, everybody. And this week, we've got a couple of guests that are actually halfway across the world from me right now. I'm in Northern California. And I know Ivan, when we first got on, said he was in the Danube, and we'll have him talk about that a little more, about where they're at. But welcome to the show, Ivan and Vasil.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
All right. So the show is titled Balkan Heritage, and this is how I was introduced to you guys. So why don't you tell us, just tell us a little bit about Balkan heritage. First, for our listeners, because geography is challenging for some people, where in the world are we talking about? Where are you guys right now? And then we'll get into a little bit of the history.
Yeah, first, what is Balkan heritage? It's a Bulgarian non-governmental cultural institution. Dealing with preservation and study of archaeological and cultural heritage in Southeastern Europe. It's an organization working at currently at four Balkan countries, Bulgaria, North Macedonia, Montenegro, and Greece. And the organization itself is a local institution, but with a broad international network, collaborating with a lot of researchers, including archaeologists and conservators from all over the world, not only from this region. Me and Vasil are Bulgarian archaeologists, and that's our location at the moment. We are in Bulgaria. Vasco?
What else can I say? We are in Bulgaria. This is southeastern Europe. And we are in different cities. Ivan is on the Danube River. But I'm on the Black Sea coast in Varna. This is one of the major Bulgarian cities. And I'm here because I'm an archaeologist in the local museum and my work is here. So, this is about our location. As for the Balkan Heritage Foundation, we work not only in Bulgaria. This is a Bulgarian foundation, by the way. But we have also projects in other countries in the Balkans, including North Macedonia and Greece and Montenegro. But most of our projects are in our country in Bulgaria.
So do you guys work for this foundation? Is this attached to a university or school somehow? How does that work?
The organization is an independent institution, and it's independent, but it's a platform for collaboration in the field of the cultural heritage study and preservation. So it collaborates with a lot of museums, research institutions, universities here in Bulgaria and across the ocean. But it's an independent organization. I'm the founder of the Balkan Heritage Foundation. It was established 12 years ago in Bulgaria. And Vasil has been since the very beginning with us. He's part of the core team of the organization, but he's currently hired by the Varna Regional History Museum.
Mm-hmm. So regarding the Balkan Heritage Foundation, I want to stay on that just for a minute. What is the goal of the Balkan Heritage Foundation? Are you guys charged with recording and preserving heritage that's out there right now? Is there a lot of stuff that just hasn't been discovered yet that you're trying to record? Or is it more of an educational mission or a mixture of both?
The foundation has two major programs, and one of them is the educational program known as the Balkan Heritage Field School. It's a program for education and training in the field of archaeology and conservation. And this program provides a lot of archaeological and conservation field schools for people from all over the world and provides access to the local heritage to all these people and also trains them in these fields and also enables them, even students, to obtain academic credits through our partner academic network. And the other important program of the Balkan Heritage is related to research and preservation of the local cultural heritage. So we are working in this part of Europe. You know, it's on the crossroad of, you know, between Mediterranean and Eastern Europe and between Western Europe and Asia. It's very interesting mm-hmm. area with a lot of cultures and civilizations. Practically, it's a mini model of Europe. Almost every yeah. civilization that has ever existed in Europe left its imprint in the Balkan area, and especially those civilizations that never got deeper in Europe, like Persia, for instance, entered the Balkans in the past. And we are from the Balkans. That's the reason why we are involved in the Balkan heritage preservation. And we want to disseminate mm-hmm. the knowledge, and we want to disseminate, you know, also the scientific access to enable the scientific access to the local cultural heritage and make more people interested in its research and preservation. And our programs for research supports mainly archaeological research and conservation research as well, and conservation activities and policies for heritage management.
Vasil, anything to add to that?
I can add that the work of the Balkan Heritage Foundation is very interesting because we work with a lot of students, and not only students, participants from all over the world. And we invite all these people to the Balkans, to Bulgaria, and to the other countries in the Balkans. And it is very interesting to present the local culture to these people that are so different, with so different backgrounds. And this cultural contact, to my opinion, is very interesting. And this is one of the most valuable things, I think, in the work of the foundation, this exchange of culture.
Our platform for collaboration in benefit of the cultural heritage deserved special attention by Europa Nostra, our jury. So they paid attention, and actually we got the special mention for our contribution to education in the field of archaeology and conservation, for sure. But it's based on this kind of collaboration between researchers, conservators, students, local communities, and bringing success to preservation of the cultural heritage when everyone is satisfied. I mean, it's based on a slightly different model than the models used by most of the colleagues here in Europe, based on funding from the state or funding from, let's say, European funding programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Awesome. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a specific expedition you guys are working on, the Fresco Hunt Photo Research Expedition. Why don't you tell us about that and how this got started?
It started during a picnic. Long time ago. Literally, we did a picnic in meadows of Western Bulgaria, beautiful area, but quite abandoned and mm-hmm. depopulated nowadays. And we discovered that the abundance of abandoned medieval churches and post-medieval churches was very high. There was a high concentration. And these churches were humble, but very often they were painted with really exquisite frescoes, and all of them mm-hmm. were abandoned. So we were considering what we can do. And in 2008, together with Vasil and some other colleagues, we started this expedition as a response to the, you know, to the disappearing post-medieval churches in this area. And this area suffered a lot from different factors, economic, political, historical, etc. And there are some explanations and reasons why this area is so depopulated nowadays. But we knew there is something precious and valuable we want to preserve. If not preserving the actual monuments, at least to create a record about their existence and communicate it with the future researchers.
How is the expedition proceeding? Like, what do you guys, I mean, it seems like a really big job to do this. So how are you organizing it? And what are the, I don't know, what are the end goals here? I mean, you said presentation of research to researchers and probably preservation, because these are these might not be standing for much longer for various reasons. How big of a job is this? What's the big area that this expedition covers?
I will start only with the geographical area and give the floor of Vasco to describe the goals of the expedition. But mm-hmm. we're talking about, the Balkans, the central Balkan zone in the very heart of Southeastern Europe, is this area mm-hmm. that is currently split between Bulgaria and Serbia. This is a highly contested border zone that in the past was actually a reason for wars between Bulgaria and Serbia, mm-hmm. especially during the late 19th and early 20th century. And this area is highly depopulated now. It's still border zone, and it's border zone of an EU country like Bulgaria and non-EU country like Serbia. And this makes things more difficult nowadays. Vasco, maybe you can describe the goals of the expedition.
Yes, of course. About the mm-hmm. goals of the expedition, I can say that this is a really very important expedition because we are exploring churches, buildings that are in a very poor state. Most of them are abandoned, or in some cases they don't have roofs, so they are exposed to the elements, and the wall paintings, especially inside, are in very bad condition. And our expedition actually collects information, documents all these frescoes and the architecture, the remains of the architecture, and we are trying to create a kind of database. And I know that it sounds awful, but in some cases, we believe that our database about those monuments will be the last database for them. Because sometimes when we visit a site several years in a row, every next year we see that the site is in a worse state. So this is the main goal, to collect information, to create a database. And the second goal, of course they are connected, is to provoke interest in the local communities, in the local institutions, and if it is possible, in the national institutions in Sofia. And this interest, if we are successful, this interest can lead to some restoration works or stuff. This is very difficult in Bulgaria, but this is the only hope for this for all these sites.
Yeah, Vasily is absolutely right, because giving an example, how can we do this? It raises public awareness not only in local level, and the local level is sometimes four grandmothers and their goats. that's the local level. I mean, but on national level, and this area is depopulated for historical reasons because of the wars in the past between mm-hmm. Bulgaria and Serbia and Yugoslavia. And this is number one. Then we had the communist period, and these churches fell into the cordon sanitaire of the Eastern Bloc. What is cordon sanitaire? Or this is the actual Iron Curtain. This is the border zone between the communist world and the outer world. I mean, the non-communist countries. Yugoslavia was not considered by the communist countries as a communist country. That's why this border was fortified. And there was a very strongly fortified strip of land, 20 kilometers going inland, with a restricted access. Even of Bulgarian citizens who lived there, they had difficulties to access their own villages and homes from inside the country. And, you know, all this was built to prevent the people living in the communist paradise to escape from it. That's why it was so efficient. I mean, you saw how many people died of the Berlin Wall, and this was the peak of the iceberg. Even more people died in the Bulgarian border zones, people from all over Eastern Europe who came to Bulgaria officially on holiday, but tried to escape to the free world at the time. And this is the second major impact, the second major problem of this area. It was for 50 years, it was isolated from the country. And of course, mm-hmm. it has economic impact of these territories. Right now, everything is fine, except there are no people.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, the scarce human resources and the scarce economic resources result in inability to maintain and preserve the remaining cultural heritage.
Yeah, let's take a break, and we will come back and continue talking about this, and then we're going to bring in some aspects of the field schools as well. So we'll be back in just a minute.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on, and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 94. And we are speaking with Ivan and Vasil. I have their last names, but for the respect out of them, I'm not going to pronounce them. They are in the show notes. I'm just not going to butcher them. So check out the show notes for their full names, and then some other links to like the Balkan Heritage Foundation, for example. So Vasil, you were mentioning these frescoes in the churches in the area that these frescoes are on, and some other paintings, architecture, things like that, that are within them. Can you talk briefly about the ages of these structures? What type of range are we talking about here? Are these things, you know, 100 years old, 500 years old, or a range of ages? Like what time periods do these date back to?
So the churches that we study are, most of them are from the time that we called post-Byzantine, which means that they were built after the fall of the Byzantine Empire in the middle of the 15th century. And most of the buildings can be dated to the late 16th and 17th century. In this period, this part of the Balkans was under the Ottoman domination. It was part of the Ottoman Empire, but there were a lot of Christian people that lived in these territories, the former Christian Balkan countries, and they built churches in this area. And no matter that, the churches were very humble from outside, I mean as architecture, because they were built in the Ottoman Empire, an empire dominated by Islam. Inside, the interior of the churches remained extremely lavishly decorated. So they were like a jewels, but from inside. And this was a very strange phenomenon. If you approach such a church from outside, you can see just a humble structure with humble masonry, nothing special, probably a cross on the roof, that will be all. But when you enter the church, you will be surrounded by a huge gallery of frescoes, of images from everywhere. And decorative program or iconographic program is actually the main thing that we study in the churches. It is a very interesting topic, and I have to say that iconography in our team, this is my superpower. So I deal mainly with iconography, with the meaning of the frescoes, and when we go to a certain church with our students, one of our first tasks is to analyze the remains of the iconographic program and to decode it. And this is really very interesting because usually the churches are in not in a good state and only parts of the decoration are still there. So we have to take these pieces and to decode them. And it is like a, like a scientific adventure. We have to put together all pieces. We have to find the whole compositions to analyze, to interpret. And I think it's a little bit like the Da Vinci Code, you know, because it's fascinating. You're going to the most forgotten place in the mountain. In an abandoned monastery, for example, you enter a church that barely can stand on its foundations. And there you can find an iconographic program with deep theological ideas presented in the images, with influences from Constantinople, from Syria, from some other exotic places. And all this incorporated in the church in that forgotten place. To me personally, this is fascinating. And this is a very important part of our work, to go to these places, to interpret, to understand the situation, and then to start a documentation, which is the other step of our work, to document everything.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I wasn't going to mention the Da Vinci Code, but I'm glad you brought it up because that's exactly what I was thinking.
let's give a broader context to the audience. So we're talking definitely for the centuries, mostly for monuments dating back to 16th, 17th centuries. But there are monuments that are not slightly, but significantly older. I mean, dating back to 14th, 15th centuries. And this is the time of the Second Bulgarian Empire and the conquest of the Second Bulgarian Empire and the Byzantine Empire by the Ottomans. And the Ottomans, actually, this is a very good example. So one can think that under the Ottomans, Christianity was banned. And probably many people still think that under the Islamic Empire, like the Ottoman Empire, Christianity was banned or constantly prosecuted. That's not the true picture. There is a significant signs of tolerance and policies that tolerated the worship, Christian worship. And more or less, the Christian communities were organized in a separate so-called people or millet that were self-governed, and they had their own rules, and they were respected by the sultans. So this is important to know. But within the Ottoman Empire, there was a great ability to move. And Christians from Syria and even Egypt and all over the Balkans were free to travel from one side of the empire to another. So it was a precondition for a great cultural exchange. Of course, most of the painters and artisans who created these churches were not from so far away. They were from Southeastern Europe, but their nationality didn't matter. Their religious belonging did matter. They were Christians. This was their first identity. No matter if they were Bulgarians, or Albanians, Serbs, Greeks, or Vlachs, all of them belonged to the Christian Orthodox Church and created this art devoted to God. Sometimes it was difficult. Vasil said something very interesting. This art is unique because it can help us trace artisan trade routes. But sometimes it was not, fully comprehended by the local shepherds, because it was built in places to educate the local shepherd or village communities. People who, although Christians, the local Bulgarian Christians were actually, they considered themselves Christians, but without the strong presence of the Orthodox Church that was, you know, under the Ottomans, it was very weak. They lost the real connection with the ecclesiastical life, and sometimes even the priests were shepherds like the rest of the community. So these people, I doubt they deeply understood this iconographic code all the time. But it helps us get back to the time of 16th century and learn about these cultural exchanges across the Eastern Mediterranean and look at the perspective of the locals, no matter if they were shepherds or highly educated monks or priests.
So that makes me think with this cultural transmission of ideas and art and the artists, you know, traveling around, and with these all being, I guess, Christian churches, you know, based in that and the idea that they're teaching the locals. Vasile, I was wondering, when you're trying to interpret what you see on some of these more degraded ones in these more country churches that haven't stood the test of time very well, are there churches from same time periods in towns and cities that are still existing that are better preserved that help you with that interpretation? Or are they all different? Are they telling different stories? I would imagine they would tell a lot of the same stories, but maybe in different ways if their goal is to educate people about Christianity.
Well, there are churches in the big cities. Some of them are preserved with some wall paintings, some of them not. Because in the cities, the situation was different and there they had other problems. In the cities, the Ottoman presence were bigger, stronger, and that's why it was more difficult to build churches there. But something else, after the liberation of Bulgaria that took place later in the 19th century, Bulgarian authorities wanted to rebuild the cities to make them look more modern, more Western European-like, etc. And in that period, late 19th and early 20th century, a lot of important medieval and post-Byzantine monuments were destroyed because of this. Mm. And they were replaced by bigger but modern churches. So the example with the big cities is not very good when we talk about this kind of post-Byzantine art. But there is something else. The iconographic program of the churches, especially that period, was very conservative. And there are some very strict rules how to decorate the interior of the church. So if you study Byzantine iconography, you would know these guidelines, let's say, or major rules. But of course, in every church, you can expect to find some unique combinations because the exact program would be decided by the commissioners, by the people, the community that would commission the decoration of the church. Those guys could be the rich man in the local village or town, or the brotherhood of a certain monastery. And in every church, you can expect something unique. Also, it is important that the decoration was made by different teams of icon painters. And those painters were traveling from place to place. Some were coming from major cities of icon painting, like Constantinople, like Thessaloniki, or Mount Athos in present-day Greece. And those people were bringing with them their iconographic traditions. So you can see that on one hand, you have conservative art and you can use the basic guidelines. But on the other hand, you have to be very careful because in every small church, you can find something very special, some new idea, some exotic influence or something like this. So it is never a boring task to decode an iconographic program, I can say.
That sounds great. It sounds really interesting. Yeah.
If I may add, actually, another problem of the big cities. There is one problem dating back to the Ottoman times. I mean, we're talking about the period of apogee of the Ottoman power. So, of course, the Islamic culture considered, I mean, the members of the Islamic community and culture considered themselves as superb. Compared to the Christianity. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to see around churches, and the churches should be hidden, and most of the Christian churches in the cities conquered by the Ottomans were converted at certain period of time. I mean, by the late 16th century, most of the most significant churches, Christian churches existing in the Christian cities conquered by the Ottomans were converted into mosques. Like Hagia Sophia in Istanbul or major churches of Thessaloniki. And this is the moment when many big monuments were converted to mosques. Number two, even new churches that were built during this time period, because there were churches built in the big cities, including Istanbul, a major Ottoman, and this is the capital. They were hidden. They were dug in the ground. They were hidden from the sight of the, you know, the Muslims. And this is one of the reasons these churches were so humble, and their architecture was not to tease the Muslims. And during the frequent rebellions, although there were long periods of tolerance, there were periods of violence. And, you know, raging Muslims often entered these temples and humiliated them or destroyed them, even burned them. This happened many times in the period of, let's say, five centuries of the Ottoman domination in Southeastern Europe. And in Bulgaria, we have another peculiarity. This is the raging communists who didn't like any religion. So on top of this, in the big cities, whatever monuments remained by the mid-20th century, the communist authorities didn't, I mean, at least by the 1960s, in the early in the late 1940s and early 50s, you know, not many, but many monuments were destroyed because they belonged to either Christianity or Islam or whatever. But the appreciation started returning. The appreciation of the old monuments started returning by the 1960s. And many monuments were actually nicely preserved and conserved by the authorities at the time. And Bulgaria was a fully communist country. But these are two more reasons about the status of preservation of these monuments and why they don't exist so much in the big cities.
We have so many reasons why in the big cities we don't have well-preserved old churches. And that's why we are focused in the rural area, outside in the mountains, in the field, where in the small villages, there are still preserved churches from 16th and 17th centuries. And there are really many. And every year we actually work in several churches because there are too many to work in all of them. And we are creating this database. The information can be, how to say, extrapolated to the big cities too, but the better preserved monuments are actually in the countryside.
One last thing, maybe that might be interesting to the audience, is about iconography representing actually the intellectual or theological perceptions of its time. But one more thing for Southeastern Europe, but that many people don't know. Imagine 14th century Europe. There were still a lot of pagan practices and pagan rituals all over Europe, preserved among the Europeans at the time. Bulgarian Orthodox Church at the time dealt with the way they could, but being destroyed by the Ottomans removed one obstacle before the pagan traditions being preserved. You know what happened in 16th and 17th century? The Catholic Church worked hard to cleanse, actually, the, you know, everyday life of Europeans, especially the Catholic Europeans, from the connections with their pagan past. There were so many folklore traditions and rituals that were actually wiped out from their everyday life because the Catholic Church was mighty, almighty. In the East, Southeastern Europe, the Orthodox Church was very weak, so nobody cared about what the local villagers do. That's why the Balkans are a huge cultural reservoir of pre-Christian traditions even nowadays that were preserved, and the iconographic programs tell us also about these practices. Many pagan traditions are now, you know, veiled Christian traditions and considered as UNESCO World Heritage as well.
Okay, well, I think that is a good spot to take our final break, and we will come back on the other side and wrap up this discussion of frescoes and churches and Balkan heritage with Ivan and Vasil. Back in just a couple minutes. may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our T Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 94, and this is the final segment on Balkan heritage. And I want to ask you guys, we've talked a lot about these churches and these frescoes and some of the architecture and things in general terms. Have there been any churches, one or two maybe, that have caught your interest the most, like something that is an excellent preservation or vasile, something that was really a puzzling mystery that you solved or something like that? Do any of these really just stick out for you guys?
As a medieval and post-medieval archaeologist, for me, a particular interest is the architecture of all these monuments. And as an archaeologist, I'm happy when we discover that some of the churches we visit, because we visit also monuments that are considered to be built in 19th century. And it particularly makes me happy when we discover traces of or evidence that the church was significantly older. Because in 19th century, this is the period of the revival of the Bulgarian nation. This is the period of the revival of the Bulgarian nationalism before the liberation of Bulgarians. And a lot of churches were renovated as a symbol of the national pride. And, just to signify this is our territory, this is our land, in contrast with the dominating Islam. And there are many churches that are believed to be built in 19th century. They were bigger and beautiful. But there are still some village churches that when we visit them, we find under the plaster, the fallen plaster walls, the wall plasters. We find frescoes that show us clearly that the frescoes date back to the post-medieval period. 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, or some architectural details when the exterior plaster fell, we can see clear evidence about reconstructions that tell us the church was built a couple of centuries earlier than it is believed. So this makes me happy.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Vasco?
I want to say something a little bit different, not so much about the intellectual challenge, but about the adventure of exploring these churches. And I want to make a comparison with the other project of the Balkan Heritage Foundation, because we have a lot of projects in our program, but the rest of the projects are archaeological excavations or some kind of restoration projects. In both cases, everything is very, very clear and well organized. We have a partnership with the local archaeological institutions. We work on a specific sites. We work with specific teams in laboratories or workshops, etc. So everything is somehow in complete order. But fresco hunting expedition is totally different, and it makes it is a unique project in our program because it is really an adventure. Every year we have a list of churches that we want to visit and to document, to explore. But in many cases we haven't been there before. So first we have to get there, and in many cases these are very remote places in some abandoned villages, let's say, or ruined monasteries, and sometimes we have to walk through a kind of jungle to cut plants. Once it was with machete, by the way, to get to the churches. Sometimes the churches are halfly ruined. Sometimes we have to crawl in the church, and I can give you two examples. They are favorite in my memories. The first example, it was an abandoned monastery not far from Sofia in the mountain. And this was one of the first years of the project. So our team was not very experienced and not very well equipped. but we were very, very motivated. And we decided to split in smaller groups and to investigate more churches. So I was with two or three students. So we had to make a hiking trip up from a village to that monastery. So we got lost several times. At the end, we found the place. And it was an amazing place. Malovo is the name. Wonderful nature. Everything was green. It was in May. Unfortunately, these bushes and trees, the wonderful one, they were all around the church. And so there was no light penetrating through the windows. And it was dark inside. And because we were not well equipped, we had only one camping gas lamp. That was it. And because the trip was very long and we had a task, so we spent the whole day with this gas lamp making our first notes and first sketches of the monument of that site. And it was like I can compare it to the expeditions of the 19th centuries to the New World. It was very exciting. And next year, we came back with better equipment. We finished everything. But our first contact with the church was fascinating. And it was a real adventure. And the second case was 2 years ago, I think, in another village very close to the Serbian border. It was a strange church. It was an old one from 17th century, I think. And some local businessmen in that village wanted to make a renovation, but because they didn't have a permission from authorities, they started to build some concrete constructions from inside.
Jeez.
From inside, yes. This project was not successful, so they abandoned everything. To get inside, we had to crawl in through the window. So they let me first inside. And in the interior was in an awful condition. Anyway, we were able to save pieces of wood carving from the iconostasis. This is the barrier between the altar and the rest of the church in the Orthodox churches. So this altar screen used to be decorated with wood carvings, but all these were broken and in pieces on the ground. So we collected some pieces. Then we managed to make a good investigation, and we found that some of the pieces of wood carving actually were very old. There were some mythical creatures, some floral ornaments, and even a crucifixion. And we called our colleagues, restorers and ethnographers from Sofia. They came to help us with this, and it was another interesting adventure, I can say, with some risks and danger, because to get into the church, it was pretty risky. But very interesting. So, as you can see, our project is not just an ordinary scientific project. It was a real adventure, and this is my favorite project of all.
Well, speaking of, that's a good segue into the last thing I want to talk about on this podcast, and that is the field school and the students that you guys bring out there. So this must be, because a field school for most students is usually one of their first experiences with actual field archaeology, and to come onto this type of project as your first experience with field archaeology must be fascinating. What is it like for students on these projects? How much time do you get to spend out there, and what kind of things do they do on the field school?
Students normally love this project, and it's attended by people between 18 and 80. And all of them love it because it combines rich theory, unexpected cultural heritage, and adventures. So what students learn, they come and have their practice for 2 weeks. Normally, the project takes 2 weeks in May. And students learn about more or less the context of this art, artifacts and monuments, about the Byzantine architecture, Byzantine iconography, and Orthodox ecclesiastical art. But on top of this, they learn more about the local specifics, and this is the theoretical part, and also about the preservation and conservation of these kind of artifacts. Hmm. But what they get is practical skills for architectural documentation, practical skills for documentation of small-scale monuments, and practical skills for also photographic documentation of small-scale monuments and organizing a photographic project, organizing an architectural recording project, and using a dumpy level, using scale drawing, etc., etc. And all these skills, they're very successful in gaining them in such a short and limited time. All of them actually contribute to the actual research project by their own works and documentation projects they get. And by the end of the project, we receive very good contributions from all the students that are actually used by us as researchers for further publications of these monuments. And all this work is just the open door towards further preservation and research efforts. Normally, these projects are followed by archaeological investigations or followed by conservators who come and actually start a conservation project, or by the local municipalities who take it over and design the complete preservation plan and preservation project. Of course, this is half of the truth. The other half of the truth is that these monuments, just next time we visit them, are half ruined or just destroyed.
Okay. I want to say thanks, guys, for coming on the show here. This has been a fascinating discussion. Is there anything else that either of you want our audience to know about Balkan Heritage or the Fresco Project or anything else that we haven't already covered?
Yeah, we're more than happy to welcome everyone who is ready to support the Balkan Heritage in general through their work, volunteer work, or through their contribution and participating in either the Balkan Heritage Field Schools or any of the volunteer research projects we are offering. We are so happy to have more than 2,000 students from all over the world who participated in our field school in the past and contributed significantly to this to our mission to preserve this heritage and make it popular and enable access to the Balkan heritage to the rest of the world. That's the most important part of our mission. So thank you. Thank you for your time and thank you for the access you provide to communicate our work here in Bulgaria and the Balkans with the rest of the world.
No problem. Vasil, anything else to add?
Well, I'm not sure, actually. I think we said that the most important things about this project of ours. And I would like to welcome everybody who is interested in old history, in Balkan history, in Byzantine art and culture to come and join us. This is really an interesting project. There is a lot of intellectual challenge, as I said. There are mysteries. There is also photography, beautiful places, beautiful nature. So if you like all these things, welcome to Bulgaria and to Balkan Heritage Foundation.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, Ivan and Vasil, again, thank you for coming on to the Archaeology Show. And I tell you what, you got me really excited. And maybe next year, if the world is back to normal, I'd really like to just get out there, do some recording with you guys in the field and see some of this awesome heritage you guys are talking about. So again, thank you for coming on the Archaeology Show, and we will be back with another great show and some You Call This Archaeology recordings. You guys might have noticed we're still doing those. So my co-host for that show, Richie, and I, we do these live recordings on Facebook Live. Try to do it every week. So if you want to join us live on those, go to arcpodnet.com/archaeology and you can see the links to those. But you can also go to facebook.com/arcpodnet, ARCHPODNET, to watch us live there. So again, thank you to Ivan and Vasil, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.